Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Nearly 2 years after 47-year-old Irina Malezic vanished from her Brooklyn apartment, the FBI had finally identified the prime suspects, Dmitry Yakovlev and his wife, Julia. Both were captured on camera using Irina's identity to make large purchases, resulting in them being hit with a slew of charges. However, what investigators originally believed to be little more than a case of identity theft would quickly grow into something far more sinister. As it turned out, Irina was not the only person to go missing after a meeting with Dmitry. Michael Klein, a former NYPD civilian employee, vanished in 2003, the same day he sold his building to a close friend of Dmitry's. 2 years later, in 2005, Viktor Alexeyev, a jeweler and neighbor of Dmitry's, went missing and was last seen alive in Dmitry's car. 2 years after that, in 2007, Irina disappeared, with Dmitry later confirming he had been the last person to see her alive as well. There was a pattern. Every 2 years, someone Dmitry knew vanished, and within days, he and his wife would reap the benefits of that missing person's bank account. As investigators worked to gather more evidence, they soon discovered they were not on the trail of your average fraudster, but instead were tracking the movements and activities of a serial killer who had avoided detection for more than a decade. And there was a good chance there were even more victims out there. This is Trace Evidence, Episode 194, The Disappearance of Irina Malezic, Part 2. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today we conclude our look into the disappearance of 47-year-old Irina Malezic and the FBI's hunt for an unknown serial killer. Before getting back into the case, just a few quick notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances. You can follow the show on social media on Twitter at TraceEvPod, Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or by searching Facebook for Trace Evidence. If you're interested in supporting the show and getting some Trace Evidence merch, there's a Patreon at patreon.com/traceevidence, or you can donate directly via PayPal. Visit trace-evidence.com for all social media links, donation options, and contact information. You can submit case suggestions through the website or email me directly at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. This year, CrimeCon will be taking place in Las Vegas, Nevada, and I'll be there representing Trace Evidence on Podcast Row. If you're planning to attend, you can use promo code TRACE to save 10% off your ticket. CrimeCon is one of my favorite events of the whole year. I love getting to meet listeners, talk about cases, and even have new cases suggested. So if you're planning to attend, visit crimecon.com and use promo code TRACE to save 10%. I can't wait to see you there. Less than 24 hours after vanishing, Irina Malezic's bank account was used for several large purchases. These transactions led back to Dmitry and his wife Julia Yakovlev. Initially believed to be little more than identity theft, the FBI would soon uncover a dark history of blood, greed, disappearances, and bodies. This is Episode 194, The Disappearance of Irina Malezic, Part 2.
Thank you.
Born and raised in Kyiv, Ukraine, Arina Malezik left her home in the spring of 2000, traveling more than 4,000 miles to the United States, where she settled in the New York borough of Brooklyn. Arina moved into an apartment on Corbin Place, located in Brighton Beach, an area known as Little Odessa, due to a large percentage of the population being made up of citizens who had emigrated from Russia and many other Eastern European countries. For several years, Arina picked up work at law offices, where her ability to speak Russian, Ukrainian, and English made her a valuable asset as a translator. After a few years, she was hired on by the government to operate as a translator in federal court cases, specifically those targeting the Russian mafia and Medicaid fraud. On Monday, October 15, 2007, Arina was last seen alive when surveillance cameras in the lobby of her building captured her exiting after 1 p.m. She was dressed in a dark jacket and appeared to be carrying a small cosmetics bag, though where she went once she'd stepped onto the sidewalk was unknown. For several months, the NYPD worked the case, though it wasn't until the FBI became involved that any progress was made. It was soon learned that a man and woman had been raiding Arena's bank account, withdrawing large sums of money within 24 hours of her disappearance. They'd also pretended to be Arina in order to obtain a credit card, which was then used for several large purchases, including two watches whose combined value was more than $16,000. Obtaining surveillance footage, federal agents were able to identify the two individuals as Dmitry and Julia Yakovlev. Both were charged with several things relating to identity theft and banking fraud. During the initial interrogations, Dmitry denied any knowledge of Arina, though he'd later admit she'd tutored him in English. Asked about using her bank card, Dmitry claimed that he'd loaned Arina $20,000 to purchase furniture, and this was how she paid him back. He claimed to have done the same to a man named Victor a few years earlier. The FBI began questioning anyone they could find who had known or met Dmitry, and soon they uncovered a trail which led them to a man named Michael Klein. Klein, who had previously worked as a mechanic for the NYPD, had vanished in 2003 after a meeting with Dmitry. He has never been found, but his apartment keys and driver's license were found in Dmitry's possession. Now, investigators could tie Dmitry to two disappearances, and in both cases, he had been the last person to see the victims before they vanished, and he'd somehow come into possession of personal and financial documents from both. As the investigation expanded, the FBI continued their work to gather additional information about Dmitry and anyone he may have associated with who had disappeared. While they served a warrant on Dmitry's home to dig up his basement based on a tip that Arina's body might be found there, other agents were canvassing different neighborhoods. Soon, they were told to track down a man named Viktor Alexeyev, a former jeweler and friend of Dmitry's. Upon obtaining Viktor's address, agents arrived at his building. However, they didn't find Viktor, instead speaking to a man named Ravil. Asking Ravil where they might find Viktor, agents were shocked when he replied, quote, "Viktor's dead. The guy murdered him whose basement you are digging up right now. He was my friend and landlord, and I suspect Dmitry Yakovlev murdered him and stole his identity." End quote. This was especially concerning when the FBI revealed that they'd found a pair of underwear bearing Irina's DNA in the Yakovlev basement, as well as possessions of Michael Klein. It was at this time that the FBI realized they were no longer investigating an identity thief, but instead, a previously undetected serial killer. We now move back into the case, beginning with Viktor Alexeyev in The Disappearance of Arina Malezik, Part 2. Viktor Alexeyev was a Russian immigrant who by the mid-2000s was missing his home country. He wanted to return to Russia and open a business, telling friends that he missed being surrounded by other Russians and wanted to return to the country and start a new life. Then, on December 18, 2005, Viktor picked up his phone and called his then-ex-girlfriend, Larissa Malishchka. According to Larissa, Viktor explained that he had refinanced his home, acquiring $100,000, and was moving back to Russia 2 days later. Before going, though, he wanted to have dinner with Larissa to say goodbye, and she agreed to meet him the next night. Viktor never showed up for dinner, though. Larissa didn't think much of it, assuming he'd gotten busy or had simply forgotten. Strangely, she'd go on to receive two calls that week. First, a woman who claimed to be named Tatiana called, asking if she knew where Victor was, but Larissa had no idea. Next, she received a call from a man who identified himself as Andrew. He was also looking for Victor, but again, she couldn't provide any information. Larissa later received a third call, again from a man, who told her that he was a friend of Victor's and he was worried about him. Larissa ultimately agreed to meet with this man, but when she showed up, she immediately recognized him. It was Dmitry Yakovlev. She'd previously met him and knew him to have been one of Victor's friends. According to Larissa, Dmitry didn't seem to remember her, but he did want to talk about Victor. He expressed concern, but when Larissa suggested they contact police, he apparently told her they were too busy to do anything about it. After stating that she didn't have any idea where he could be, the conversation took a strange turn. Dmitry began hitting on her, asking if she'd like to go out sometime. When Larissa pointed out that he was married and had a child, Dmitry was dismissive of it, saying that it didn't matter, they could still spend time together. Larissa wasn't interested, and following this meeting, she didn't speak to Dmitry again, though at the time, she had no idea that Victor's disappearance was connected to him. The FBI followed the money when it came to Victor and discovered that he'd purchased a one-way ticket from JFK International Airport to Moscow, but he'd never boarded the plane. 2 weeks after Victor called Larissa, on January 2, 2006, a new cell phone account was opened in his name. The next day, a second account was opened in his name, despite the fact that no one had seen Victor since mid-December. At first, the feds didn't think they could do much with this information. Sure, Victor was missing, but he'd been telling everyone he was going back to Russia, so it sort of made sense for him to be gone. Reveal, however, would give them additional information that would turn the story on its head. According to him, on December 19th, the day Victor was supposed to have dinner with Larissa, Reveal saw him sitting in the passenger seat of Dmitry's Lexus SUV. This is now the third missing person who Dmitry was apparently the last person to see alive. Except, unlike Irina and Michael Klein, Victor wasn't missing at all. On January 8, 2006, 3 days after the second cell phone account was open in Victor's name, Andrew Romo, an officer with the Irvington Police Department, was on patrol near South Mountain Reservation in Essex County, New Jersey, approximately 30 miles west of Dmitry's Seagate neighborhood. Driving down the road, he quickly spotted several black trash bags dumped in a wooded area. Stepping out of his vehicle, Romo walked into the woods and approached the bags. Attempting to lift one, he found it to be extremely heavy, so he quickly cut the bag open and was horrified by what he saw. A pair of human shins spilled out onto the dirt. In total, there were four bags. One contained a set of shins, another held a pair of arms, the third contained someone's thighs, and the fourth contained a pair of sweatpants. Even more bizarrely, just a few feet from the bags, lying on a bed of leaves, Romo found a ghoulish Dracula Halloween mask. Investigators arriving on the scene had determined that the human remains had likely been refrigerated for some time prior to being dumped. They also noted that they hadn't recovered a complete set of human remains, showing that the hands, feet, head, and torso were all missing. The remains had to be taken to the medical examiner's office, where a pathologist was able to go over the body parts, finding that this had been no hack job. Whoever had dismembered the body knew what they were doing and likely had anatomical knowledge, if not outright training as a surgeon. The assailant had disarticulated the limbs, meaning this person knew how to cut around the bone and sever limbs without needing to cut through the bone itself. While they could not identify the remains by sight, a DNA test would later confirm they belonged to the missing Victor Alexeyev. According to the FBI, the NYPD did interviews with many of Victor's friends following the identification, and while many of them believed he had likely been killed by Dmitry, no one actually possessed any hard evidence. For their part, the NYPD did interview Dmitry about the crime, but he claimed to know nothing about it, and without further evidence, there was little they could do. When Special Agent Abrams followed up in 2009, several of Victor's friends told him that Dmitry had called them in the weeks following his disappearance, asking if they knew the combination to his safe, which many of them found obviously extremely suspicious. Returning to Victor's building, the landlord explained that after Victor vanished, anytime a new tenant arrived, Dimitri would show up out of nowhere, saying he needed to search the apartment for money that he'd left behind. Unlike the NYPD in 2006, however, Special Agent Abrams had more evidence to work with. Re-examining the pornographic photos they'd found in Dimitri's home, they were able to confirm that the man in those pictures was, in fact, Victor. It was reported that Victor and Dimitri looked a lot like one another, so much so that friends often made jokes about it. So, why did Dimitri have these pictures? Was he blackmailing Victor, or had he obtained them after the man's death? They still didn't know who the woman was, but there was another piece of information to tie Dimitri to Victor's murder. At the time of his death, multiple people confirmed that Victor had worn and owned a Patek Philippe watch, very similar to one found in Dimitri's safe. After confirming that the watch Dimitri had did in fact belong to Victor, the FBI found a disturbing detail. Apparently, after killing Victor, Dimitri had taken his watch and had it engraved to read, "To Dimitri from Friends." According to Special Agent Abrams, they'd managed to establish a pattern. Almost on the regular, every 2 years, Dimitri would murder someone and steal their identity. There was Michael Klein in 2003, Viktor Alexeyev in 2005, and now Irina Malezik in 2007. Dimitri had been smart with his targets. He selected loners, people who live mostly isolated lives who didn't have a large circle of friends. He dumped Victor's body in a high crime area where he figured investigators wouldn't look too deeply. He abandoned Michael Klein's car, not far from that same spot. For those whose bodies weren't found, they'd be listed as missing, but he knew without more information, those cases would grow cold. Abrams explained, quote, "He took advantage of some things that helped him stay off the radar. Missing persons will never be treated the same as murder victims, especially adults who are socially isolated with no family members, people with very light ties to the community. All three victims had something going on in their lives that indicated that it would be consistent for them to just disappear," end quote. For an investigation which had begun as that of identity theft, things had dramatically changed. They now had three separate people whose identities had been stolen and their bank accounts raided. Two of them remained missing, and one was found spread across four separate garbage bags set beside a bloody mouth Dracula mask. Wondering if perhaps there might be additional victims, Special Agent Abrams began gathering all of the information he could about Dimitri in hopes that maybe he could be tied to some other unsolved cases. According to the FBI, when Dimitri lived in Russia, he trained and worked as a surgeon, which furthered the potential connection to the dismemberment of Victor's body. He left Russia in 1997, coming to the United States where he reinvented himself, telling two separate stories. To some, he claimed he was on the run from the Russian mafia. To others, he said he was still an active member of the Russian mob. Upon arriving in the United States, the first place Dimitri lived was a series of large red brick apartments in Newark, known as Ivy Hill. Riddled with crime, Ivy Hill was described as the kind of place you don't want to go after nightfall, where drug dealers are lurking on the corners, apartments are robbed daily, and muggers wait on the stairwells for unsuspecting victims. It's the type of place that even the police don't go into unless they have to, and if they do, they don't come without a lot of backup. Dimitri only lived in Ivy Hill for a few months before moving on to Brooklyn, where he suddenly had enough money to begin his real estate flipping business, obtaining much of which would fund his future projects and ritzy lifestyle. The thing was, while Dimitri may have left Newark, Ivy Hill seemingly never left him. South Mountain Reservation, where Victor's body had been found, was less than 3 miles west of the apartment complex. Michael Klein's car had been found abandoned less than 5 miles from that complex. It appeared that, given the high crime rate and danger of the area, Dimitri had hidden his early crimes by disposing of evidence in a place where he knew investigators weren't going to ask too many questions, and if they did, they weren't going to get very many answers. However, as Abrams dug into Dimitri, he soon discovered another unsolved crime that fit his MO, one which, at that point and today, remains unsolved. More than 10 years earlier, in October of 1998, approximately a year after Dimitri arrived in Newark, sanitation workers made a grisly discovery. Arriving at the Ivy Hill apartment complex, they began gathering up garbage bags for their biweekly pickup when a few different bags stood out. While the complex used gray bags, workers found several large, heavy black ones mixed in. Now, it wasn't uncommon for locals to try and sneak their garbage into the complex's pile, but something was different about these bags. Noting their extreme weight, sanitation workers quickly opened the bags and discovered human remains. Investigators called to the scene remarked that there wasn't much left, noting that they'd recovered part of a head and some limbs. The victim was a white male, and being that the vast majority of white people living in Ivy Hill are of Eastern European or Russian descent, they assumed the man was likely from that area. When Special Agent Abrams stumbled across this, he quickly learned that, much like Viktor Alexeyev, this John Doe had been efficiently and expertly disarticulated in a manner very much the same. Unfortunately, they were never able to identify this John Doe, who is listed on NamUs as UP-1607. Without more information, they couldn't tie that man to Dimitri, with Abrams noting, quote, "There's really nothing more we can do. At this point, we don't have any leads," end quote. So putting things in order, you've got John Doe, dismembered and killed sometime around October 1998. Michael Klein, missing with his identity and financial information stolen November 2003. Viktor Alexeyev, dismembered, identity stolen December 2005. And Irina Malezik, missing, identity stolen October 2007. If indeed the FBI is right and Dimitri operated on a 2-year clock, he either grew lazy for the 5-year stretch between 98 and 03, or there could be yet another unknown, unlinked victim out there. I've looked through NamUs for any dismembered bodies found during that time, as well as going through lists of missing persons. To say there's a lot to sort through is an understatement, but faced with the options that either Dimitri took a break from killing, or he was killing but has never been tied to it, I would take the latter. In March of 2010, U.S. attorneys presented evidence to a grand jury regarding both Dimitri and Julia. On Thursday, March 4th, Dimitri was indicted for the murder of Irina, while both he and Julia were additionally indicted on charges that they'd stolen the identities of Viktor Alexeyev and Michael Klein. Police Commissioner Raymond Kelly addressed the indictments, telling the Daily News, quote, "Identity theft victims usually lose their money. In this case, they allegedly lost their lives, too. That's why this investigation and prosecution takes on special meaning for all those involved in bringing it to a successful conclusion," end quote. 5 months later, in August of 2010, the FBI sought and obtained a court order requiring Dimitri to present them with a DNA sample. They also took Dimitri's Lexus SUV into custody, at which time they began sweeping for evidence, arguing that they believe both Irina and Viktor had been in the vehicle in the moments immediately preceding their disappearances. While Julia's defense lawyer attempted to argue that neither the photos of Viktor nor the panties found in the basement should be admitted to the case, where she was being tried separately, the government noted that the items were recovered from within the family home where Julia was still living. According to Anna Val, Julia's lawyer, her client had no knowledge of any of those items and was shocked to learn that they'd been found in the house. While Julia's lawyers attempted to show that she had no knowledge or involvement in the murders, the prosecution pointed out how, in the weeks following her arrest, she had cut her long hair to a much shorter length and dyed it a different color. Retired NYPD Detective Vernon Gieberth noted the importance of this change when it came to trial, telling reporters, quote, "It's extremely significant that the bleached blonde in the videos looks nothing like the present model," end quote. 6 months later, in February of 2011, Julia decided her best option was to work with investigators. On Monday, February 2nd, Julia made the decision to enter a guilty plea. Julia admitted to using credit cards in Irina's name to make big purchases, taking a plea deal which would remove murder charges. As a result of her plea, Julia was facing a maximum sentence of 40 months in prison. This left Dimitri to go to trial on all of the other charges. While at the time, Julia's lawyer argued that her client was still married to and close with Dimitri, investigators noted that upon their first visit to the couple's Surf Avenue home, They'd found the husband and wife living in different quarters within the home and no longer sharing a bedroom. 3 weeks later, on Wednesday, February 23rd, Dmitri's trial was already underway. Prosecutors began presenting evidence to the jury to support their argument that Dmitri had murdered both Irina and Victor, subsequently using their credit cards and financial accounts within days of their disappearances. On this day, they dug deep into Victor's murder, showing the jury photographs of the Dracula mask found nearby to where his severed remains were recovered. While a DNA test conducted on the mask failed to connect it directly to Dmitri, prosecutors were able to present eyewitness testimony showing that Victor had last been seen alive inside of Dmitri's vehicle. In his opening statement, defense attorney Michael Gold argued that investigators had absolutely no evidence tying his client to any murders, nor even any proof of how he could have killed them, saying, quote, "There is no forensic evidence Mr. Yakovlev in any way, shape, or manner or form contributed to her disappearance," end quote. The jury was then shown Dmitri's immigration application in which he listed himself as a former surgeon at Hospital No. 21 in Russia from 1995 to 1996. Dr. Lila Perez, a forensic pathologist, was called to the stand while U.S. Assistant Attorney Amanda Hector wheeled out a life-size skeleton to show the jury how Dmitri had severed Victor's limbs. Dr. Perez explained, quote, "Disarticulation is the process of taking apart a limb from the joint without hacking or using a saw. The disarticulation was very clean. I thought the person who does that had anatomic knowledge," end quote. Jurors gasped as an autopsy photo was shown on the big screen, displaying how Victor's upper leg had been removed at the hip with no visible damage to the joint. Michael Gold tried to argue against this kind of work, saying that it didn't require a surgeon's knowledge, asking Dr. Perez if this was similar to how someone might carve a Thanksgiving Day turkey. When the conversation turned towards Michael Klein, it was noted that no one had ever filed a missing persons report for the man. As it turned out, that wasn't for a lack of trying. Alexander Hamilton, who had provided the FBI with a great wealth of knowledge about Dmitri, testified that he had tried to report Klein missing to the NYPD, but they had shown little interest. According to Hamilton, he had told the police of his suspicions that Dmitri had killed the former NYPD employee before stealing his identity, but as he explained, quote, "They said they couldn't start an investigation on my word alone," end quote. As it turned out, Hamilton wasn't the only one who had tried. Klein's sister, Margaret, had also attempted to file a missing persons report, but in her words, she was ignored. She later told the Daily News, quote, "I don't think my brother is on the planet anymore. I want to understand what happened. It's part of putting it to rest. My brother was eccentric, but he was a very peaceful, gentle man," end quote. Several days later, on Tuesday, March 1st, prosecutors presented evidence that Dmitri had lied to them when he claimed that Irina had gone back to Russia. Assistant Attorney Amanda Hector explained to the jury, quote, "He knew what happened to her. He killed her," end quote, noting that within hours of Irina's disappearance, Julia was on the phone with credit card companies pretending to be her in an attempt for the couple to get their hands on as much of Irina's money as they could. In an attempt to counter this, Michael Gold argued that Irina was missing. No body had been found to prove that she'd been killed at all. Gold also noted that Irina had problems, claiming that she was struggling with alcoholism and personal issues. In his closing argument, he pointed out how no DNA nor fingerprints had been recovered from the Dracula mask, though prosecutors had already stated that, with Dmitri having surgical experience, they believed it was likely he'd worn surgical gloves during the dismemberment. 2 days later, on March 3rd, the jury returned a guilty verdict following 7 hours of deliberation. Ultimately, Dmitri was found guilty on all 15 charges, which included conspiracy, bank fraud, identity theft, and illegally using credit cards. According to the Daily News, Dmitri seemed unfazed by the guilty verdict, turning to smile at his lawyer as he was taken into custody. Members of the jury would later tell the media that it seemed quite clear that Dmitri had tried to drain the bank accounts of his victims rapidly within days of their disappearances, in what they believed was an attempt to get as much money as possible before authorities could become involved and the accounts would be frozen. While Dmitri's sentencing was scheduled for later in the year, Julia would go before Judge Leo Glazer just 2 months later in May. Julia attempted to claim she was little more than a pawn in Dimitri's game, arguing that she was afraid of her husband and had been subjected to abuse at his hands. Judge Glazer, however, wasn't buying what she was selling and ultimately sentenced her to 3 years in federal prison. Judge Glazer expressed to Julia his disbelief, noting that she'd been divorced twice before in her life, so she certainly could have left Dimitri as well, but she didn't, choosing instead to continue living a luxurious life with big homes, nice cars, and expensive watches. Julia argued that she didn't know when she was committing identity theft that the victim, Irina, had been harmed in any way, to which Judge Glazer replied, quote, "You personally represented yourself as Irina Malezic. To stand here and tell me you had no idea what you were doing is startling," end quote. 4 months later, a hearing was held to sentence Dimitri. Assistant U.S. Attorney James Gaeta argued that Dimitri should face a life sentence, telling the judge, quote, "The conduct here is extraordinary. It shocks the conscience. The defendant, for lack of a better way of putting it, is a serial killer." Immediately following the disappearance of each of the victims, Dmitry Yakovlev was using their identities to go shopping for himself, end quote. Being that Dmitry had not been charged with nor found guilty of murder, Michael Gold argued that he should receive an appropriate sentence for what he was found guilty of, the lesser of which would have been 108 months in prison. However, Judge Glazer considered that ridiculous. Glazer explained that sentencing Dmitry to such a short time in prison would be, quote, "an affront to common sense," end quote. Ultimately, Glazer sentenced Dimitri to serve 30 years in federal prison. In addition to this, he ordered that Dimitri forfeit $432,050 in restitution for the fraud he had committed. While Dimitri elected not to speak at his sentencing, Judge Glazer had a lot to say, telling him, quote, "You're responsible for the disappearance and murder of three human beings," end quote. Glazer went further, attributing Dimitri's motive to either incredible greed or psychopathy. Dimitri was remanded to federal prison, with his release date set for 2035. However, searches through the Bureau of Prisons failed to return any mention of him, indicating that he's either listed under a different name or perhaps has died. At least one of my sources listed his date of death as being November of 2016, but I can't verify this information. For her part, Julia served her sentence and was released from prison in May of 2014. While Dimitri was sentenced to prison, questions still remain. What happened to Irina Malezic that October afternoon in 2007 when she left her apartment and climbed into his car? Was she brought back to his Surf Avenue home and murdered, possibly in the basement, before being dismembered and disposed of? Then there's Michael Klein, who to this day is a missing person, despite the fact that he's not listed in NamUs nor any other missing persons directory. Unfortunately, it seems, we may never have these answers, and we may never see murder charges directly filed. For Irina's family, it's been difficult to conceive of, knowing their daughter left Ukraine to form a better life and instead was brutally murdered by a greedy psychopath who didn't hesitate to kill for money. Viktor Alexeyev was last seen alive on the evening of Monday, December 19, 2005, in the Lexus SUV of Dmitry Yakovlev. He had purchased a one-way ticket to Moscow, however, he never arrived for his flight. His dismembered remains were discovered near South Mountain Reservation in Essex County, New Jersey, on January 8, 2006. Neither his hands, feet, torso, or head have ever been recovered. Michael Klein was last seen alive in November of 2003. According to Dimitri, he was the last person to see Klein before he drove off in his white Toyota, which was later found abandoned just a few miles from the location of Victor's remains. While his sister believes he was murdered, no trace of him nor his remains has ever been found. On October 13, 1998, investigators with the New Jersey State Police were called to the Ivy Hill apartment complex in Newark, New Jersey. There, they recovered the partial remains of a white male who had been dismembered and put into garbage bags. His height was estimated to have been approximately 5 feet 8 inches tall, while his weight was estimated to have been 205 pounds. He had short, dark brown hair and a mustache. There's also a surgical scar on his abdomen. He's believed to have been around 30 years old, and his date of death was determined to have been within days of his remains being found. 24 years later, He remains unidentified, and the only potential suspect in his death is Dmitry Yakovlev. At the time of her disappearance, Irina Malezik was described as a white female with brown hair and eyes, standing 5 feet 2 inches tall and weighing 110 pounds. She was born in Ukraine and speaks Russian and English. Both of her ears were pierced. She was last seen on surveillance cameras in the lobby of her 200 Corbin Place apartment building on the afternoon of Monday, October 15, 2007. She was wearing a dark-colored jacket and carrying what appeared to be a small cosmetics case. At the time of her disappearance, Irina was 47 years old, and if alive today, would be turning 62 this July. 15 years ago, Irina Malezik left her apartment for the last time. For a decade and a half, the answers have remained elusive. While Dmitry Yakovlev was sent to prison for his involvement, he has not had to fully pay the price for his crimes. Irina's friends continue to hope that someday, somehow, her remains will be found, so that she might be given a proper burial, either in her chosen home of New York, or perhaps returned to her native Ukraine. Her parents have never gotten the justice nor the closure they so desperately hoped for, and while Dmitry was locked away, he never revealed the location of any of his victims, nor admitted guilt for the brutal and violent horrors he subjected them to. For all we know, there could be several more victims out there who have not yet been connected to this grim figure, both in the United States and in Russia, who has now become known as the Dracula Vampire Killer. That sound always makes me smile. It's the sound of another sale on Shopify, the all-in-one commerce platform to start, run, and grow your business. Shopify gives entrepreneurs the resources once reserved for big business, so upstarts, startups, and established businesses alike can sell everywhere, synchronize online and in-person sales, and effortlessly stay informed. Scaling your business is a journey of endless possibility. I love how Shopify has the tools and resources that make it easy for any business to succeed from down the street to around the globe. Like mine, Shopify powers over millions of businesses from first sale to full scale. Reach customers online and across social networks with an ever-growing suite of channel integrations and apps, including Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Pinterest, and more. Gain insights as you grow with detailed reporting of conversion rates, profit margins, and beyond. More than a store, Shopify grows with you. This is Possibility, powered by Shopify. Go to shopify.com/trace, all lowercase, for a free 14-day trial and get full access to Shopify's entire suite of features. Grow your business with Shopify today. Go to shopify.com/trace right now. Shopify.com/trace.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
At 47 years old, Irina Malezik was doing pretty good for herself. Emigrating to the United States at 40, she became a U.S. citizen, worked for several law firms, and eventually was hired on to be a translator for the federal court system. She had friends, family, dreams for her future, and hope to forge a better life. Instead, she comes into contact with a killer by sheer coincidence, and from that day forward, her time was seemingly limited. That seems to be the story of several people, including Michael Klein and Viktor Alexeyev. It didn't matter if you were friends for years or an acquaintance for days. Once you were on Dmitry Yakovlev's radar, the only way you might be safe was if your finances didn't provide him with enough greed to want to take it from you. That makes this case somewhat different from what I usually cover here. Oftentimes, I dig into cases where someone has vanished and there aren't a lot of clues, or someone was murdered and maybe there's a suspect or a person of interest, but it's rare to cover one where we pretty much know who did it and why. I mean, I focus on unsolved cases, so some of you might be wondering why I decided to tackle this one. Well, there's a few reasons. Regardless of Dmitri being imprisoned and tried, there's still a lot of unanswered questions. Where are Irina and Klein? Were they dismembered and dumped somewhere where they've never been connected? Did he maybe dispose of them in the ocean or in an area which hasn't yet been associated with his crimes? What most compelled me, however, was the other side of the equation. We know about Irina, Klein, Alexeyev, and the John Doe, who was more than likely a victim of Dmitri's. However, there's a high likelihood that there are other victims out there who no one's managed to connect to Yakovlev. Maybe they were never reported missing. Maybe their bodies were found but never identified. In most cases of serial killers, they have more victims than they're ever connected to. In a lot of cases, they artificially inflate their numbers to make themselves seem more accomplished, for lack of better terms. That's how it seems to work in their minds. The atrocities they commit give them some kind of station, and they work hard to make their position seem grander than it actually is. It's one of the dark ironies of cases involving serial killers. They're proud of things the general public consider hideous, and they revel in the horrors they've committed because in their minds, it's quite an accomplishment. Dmitri is somewhat different. Sure, we've had talkative serial killers and then ones who deny everything until the end, and maybe Yakovlev fits into that latter group. But it is strange that from the moment he was arrested, through his trial, and into prison, he's never discussed the murders at all. From what's been made available by the FBI, he acknowledged knowing these people, minus the John Doe, but claims he didn't kill them. That's nothing new in a situation like this, though I'd really love to know what his reaction was when he was shown autopsy photos of Victor, when he was shown Irina's underwear found in his own basement, or Klein's license. I find it hard to imagine he was able to just ignore everything and continue denying, but seemingly, interrogators never managed to trip him up when it came to the murders. It's kind of odd when you think about it. He volunteered Victor's name. He admitted he lied about Irina. He put himself in a position where he acknowledged being the last person to see all three of them alive, yet when it came to questions about the murders themselves, he never misspoke. He never let anything slip through. So if we take an overview of the case, we know quite a lot. On and off, over stretches of 2 years between 2003 and 2007, Dmitri played a role in the disappearance of Michael Klein, the dismemberment of Victor Alexeyev, and the disappearance of Irina Malezik. He chose his victims wisely. Socially isolated, financially secure, light ties to the community, and few people who would go out of their way to report them missing or even notice. He knew that by choosing his victims as he did, the chances of anyone noticing were mild, but the chance that anyone would connect to him were even slimmer. Which is strange, since it seems, with both Victor and Klein, there were several people who were concerned and suspected him, but it never went anywhere. Whether you want to chalk that up to his own cunning or a lack of investigation, I'd say it's a combination of the two. When you're dealing with an area that receives a large number of missing persons reports every year, who are the police going to look hard for? The 20-year-old college student with tons of friends who went missing after a party, or the retired reclusive hoarder living alone? Not saying that that's right, not in the least, but realistically, I think we know what the answer is. Dmitri never saw these people as anything more than what they could give to him. He meets Michael Klein in late 2003, and by the end of the year, Klein's missing and Dmitri has his financial information. He befriends Victor Alexeyev, maintains that friendship, and for a period of time, right when Victor wants to move back to Russia, Dmitri seizes upon the opportunity, and within a few weeks he's got his money and he's opening cell phone accounts in his name. Dmitri eventually meets Irina through his legal issues with Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton, by the way, is someone who is probably lucky that Dmitri never killed him. And Irina works for this law firm as a translator. He gives her a ride home, and seemingly from that point forward, he works his way in. She tutors him in English, for how long exactly we don't know, but he follows his pattern. He keeps Irina around until he decides it's time to take what she has, her life and her money. Honestly, I think for Dmitri, murder was secondary to the theft. It was a means to an end. He never saw his victims as human beings, but rather as ATMs. The first thing, and really the main thing, that's always bothered me about this case are the different MOs. We've got the body of a John Doe, missing Michael Klein, the body of Victor Alexeyev, and missing Irina. Why does he dump some bodies and conceal others? Initially, I thought he'd started dumping bodies and later moved on to concealing the remains, but instead he kind of bounces back and forth. It's bizarre. He knew making them disappear gave him a higher chance of avoiding detection, and yet he still goes out of his way not only to dump Victor's body, but to leave behind the Dracula mask like some kind of bizarre calling card. Was he trying to send a message with the mask? Did he leave it there accidentally? It's hard to imagine he'd make that mistake, but given that the mask had no DNA nor fingerprints on it, I doubt leaving it behind was an error. I think, more than likely, he didn't even wear that mask. He just threw it down to add confusion, which appears to have worked since Victor wasn't connected to him for another 4 years. The FBI has made it clear that Dimitri operated in a pattern, striking approximately every 2 years, usually in the fall or winter. That can be tracked back to October 1998 when John Doe was found at Newark's Ivy Hill Apartments. But there's a strange gap there. No victims between 1998 and 2003, a span of 5 years during which he should have had at least one, maybe two victims. Somewhere around 2000 or 2001. Maybe he got busy. Maybe he wasn't needing cash at the time, or maybe he did strike and either the missing person wasn't reported or the report was ignored, or a body was found, but they didn't have any clues to make a connection to Dimitri or anyone else. We know that at different times in their lives, serial killers will break their patterns for random amounts of time. Maybe they get into a relationship, get a new job, find something that keeps them busy, or they just happen to suppress that urge to kill for a while. The problem is, if you search through missing persons lists in places like Namus and the Doe Network, there's a lot of victims who could have been someone Dimitri targeted. Then you also have to consider that you're not working with all of the information. Michael Klein, for instance, has never been listed as a missing person, so there's a good chance other victims may not be listed either, especially if they were so socially isolated that there was no one to report them missing. The fact of the matter remains, we simply have no way of knowing exactly how many victims Dimitri may have. We know he arrived in the United States in 97, and John Doe was killed less than a year later, dumped right in the garbage pile of Dimitri's old apartment complex. Somehow, Dimitri ends up with enough cash to start his real estate flipping business around this time, moves out to Brooklyn, and starts buying fancy watches, expensive cars, and big homes. Here's the thing, though. If indeed John Doe is one of Dimitri's victims, that crime is committed when he's 31. He isn't arrested until he's 42. What are the chances that Dimitri didn't kill for the first time until his early 30s? Sure, it's possible, but what if there's a lot more to the story than this? Dimitri comes to the United States in 97. On his immigration application, he lists his job as being a surgeon at Hospital Number 21 in Russia. Given the skilled disarticulation of the dismembered bodies, it seems quite apparent that this wasn't a lie, and he did have surgical training and likely worked as a surgeon for a period of time. According to multiple sources, the average salary for a surgeon in Russia around this time was approximately 298,000 rubles per month, which translates to around $4,000 a month. That's not a bad living, so I can't help but wonder what made him decide to move from Russia, where he was a surgeon, to the United States, where he'd essentially have to start all over. It wasn't until I started digging deeper into this case that I began wondering, what if Dimitri didn't leave Russia because he wanted to, but because he had to? Unfortunately, we have no way of knowing what Dimitri was up to when he was in Russia, but I think it's safe to assume he'd already done or attempted some criminal activities. Maybe it was merely identity theft at the time, but I don't think we could rule out the possibility that he may have killed before coming to the U.S. If indeed the Ivy Hill John Doe was his first victim stateside, you're looking at a disarticulated set of human remains that, based upon the word of several forensic pathologists, was not a hack job and showed that the killer had experience. I doubt that 2 years out of being a surgeon, Dimitri was able to dissect the body so professionally without having had done something similar before. We can even note the evolution between John Doe and Victor Alexeyev, as with Victor, nothing is found but limbs. No fingers, no toes, no head, no torso. But with John Doe, he leaves part of the head behind, a decision he would learn from and not repeat. But here's another wild question that's been eating away at me. Can we know with absolute certainty that this man actually is Dmitry Yakovlev? He's a man who spent much of his time in the U.S. stealing identities, forging signatures, and financial documents. Perhaps he was known by another name in Russia, Or maybe he stole someone's identity and used that to apply for immigration. If he had some kind of a violent criminal background in Russia, it may have been more difficult to get into the U.S., so it would make sense to use stolen or fraudulent identities. I imagine the FBI dug into this, but I'm not sure how exceptional the communication is between the U.S. and Russia when it comes to looking into an applicant's background. Also, I think you have to keep in mind this was pre-9/11, so they probably weren't as stringent. Maybe that's an out-there idea, but it's one I can't resist addressing. Someone who steals identities to support his lifestyle probably knows how to create a fake identity for himself as well, let alone how to use someone else's. In the end, this is just a terrible situation where you may be able to define it as partially solved, but the more you dig, the more you realize you know almost nothing. Dmitry could certainly have had different victims out there, and more than likely does. At a minimum, it seems highly likely that John Doe was one of, if not the first person to fall victim to Dmitry, at least in the United States. Then, after a five-year gap between 98 and 03, he kills and steals an identity every 2 years. He dumps John Doe's body, Victor's remains, and Michael Klein's car, all within a few miles of the Ivy Hill apartment complex he first lived in. Something had to have changed between 98 and 2000. If Dmitry had the money to live in a better area or a more expensive building, I imagine he would have. But instead, he originally settled in Ivy Hill and then, somehow, comes up with the money to move to Brooklyn and begin a real estate business. Maybe, if John Doe's identity could be determined, we might be able to find other connections between Dmitry and another missing or murdered person. So what do you think happened? Did Dmitry come to the U.S. and only then begin murdering and stealing identities? Or is it possible that back in Russia, he'd committed similar crimes? Did he really take those 5 years off? Or are there more victims out there who have never been, and sadly at this point, likely never will be connected to him? I always love to hear what you folks think about cases. Oftentimes, you come up with angles and theories that never even occurred to me. All we can really say for certain is that Dmitry Yakovlev is a serial killer with at least 3 victims and likely at least 4. In Victor's case, he was going to leave the country, so Dmitry had to strike before it was too late. When it came to Michael Klein, he'd sold his home and was moving away again, so he had to act quickly. What exactly caused him to kill Irina? Was she planning on going somewhere? Had she threatened to report Dmitry to the police for harassing her, or was he simply wanting to spend a little more money, and she was the easiest available option? These are the questions that need to be answered. It's been 15 years since Irina Malezik walked out of her Brighton Beach apartment and never returned. According to Dmitry, after exiting the building, she climbed into his car, and what happened to her after that is anyone's guess, although I think we all know Irina Malezik is no longer alive. Unfortunately, however, without more information, new evidence, or someone coming forward, the disappearance of Irina Malezik, the murder of Viktor Alexeyev, and the disappearance of Michael Klein, as well as the murder of John Doe, will remain open, unsolved, and growing cold. If you're looking for more information about the disappearance of Irina Malezik, the New York Daily News and New York Post provided the most in-depth coverage. I'd also like to mention journalist Jonathan Veit, who wrote an article entitled The Devil in Little Odessa for Medium.com. That article provided me with a wealth of details and sources to track down, and I'd highly recommend checking it out if this case has caught your attention. If you have any information about the disappearance of Irina Malezik and Michael Klein, or the murders of Viktor Alexeyev and the Ivy Hill John Doe, please contact the New York City Police Department's Missing Persons Squad at 212-694-7781. Irina's case number is KNMP318. You can also contact the FBI online by visiting tips.fbi.gov. Or you can give them a call at 1-800-CALL-FBI. That's 1-800-225-5324. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod. Message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod. Email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com or comment in the Facebook group. Just a quick reminder that I'll be attending CrimeCon in Las Vegas, representing Trace Evidence on Podcast Row. To save 10% off your pass, use promo code TRACE at CrimeCon.com. Trace Evidence would not be possible without support from amazing listeners like you. And now I'd like to take a moment to thank our fantastic Patreon producers, Alicia Lorraine, Anne Bertram, Brittany Bivens, Christine Greco, Krista Colvin, Denise Dingsdale, Donna Buttram, Diane Dyson, Eamon Brady, Eloanne Meyer, Eric Sumpter, Guillerme Pinto, Haley Christie, James, Jen Treb, Jennifer Winkler, Jill Sense, Joni Berkowitz, Julie Mangano, Kara Moreland, Lars Jensen Fangel, Leslie B., Marla Wright, Melissa Brakeisen, Nick Mohar Schurz, Orange Patches, Quinn McBreen, Roberta Jansen, Sarah Levinen, Sarah Lyons, Travis Skepko, Stacy Finnegan, Stephanie Joyner, Stephanie Eve, Adorable Susie Summers, Taylor, Tom Archer, Tom Radford, and Tracy Woods. Your contributions to Trace Evidence are invaluable, and your support of the show is both appreciated and extremely humbling. If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence and gaining access to exclusive merch and ad-free episodes, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence or go to trace-evidence.com and click on the support option. This concludes our two-part look into the disappearance of Irina Malezic, a sad, disturbing, and complicated case that to this day is filled with haunting questions that have yet to be answered. Hopefully, someday, we'll find the truth here. But until then, I want to thank you again for listening, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.